Hello and welcome to the Science Magazine podcast for May 1st, 2009. I'm Robert Frederick. This week, The Evolutionary History of Africans and African Americans, an essay on the origins of the immune system, and we'll read from your letters to Science Magazine. All this and more, plus a wrap-up of some of the latest science news, including a story about instant sunglasses from our online daily news site, Science Now.
Support for the Science Magazine podcast is provided by AAAS, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, advancing science, engineering, and innovation throughout the world for the benefit of all people. AAAS, the Science Society, at www.aaas.org.
Modern humans all came from Africa, but genetic studies have tended so far to underrepresent African populations. In a paper published online by Science, Sarah Tishkoff and colleagues have sought to amend that. I spoke with Tishkoff from her office at the University of Pennsylvania in Philadelphia and asked her first about the goals of the study.
The goal of this study was to do a more thorough characterization of genetic diversity both within and among a broad set of African populations. And we think this is important both to learn more about African population history, about African American ancestry, and to set the stage for future genetic studies of genetic risk factors for disease, as well as studies of how people respond to drugs and what some of the genetic basis might be for differences in drug response.
So how many people did you and your team get DNA from, and what were their phenotypes or apparent backgrounds, or indeed self-described genetic backgrounds?
So for this particular study, we had approximately 4,000 individuals, including individuals from 121 African populations, 4 African American populations, and 60 non-African populations. And these represent both geographically and ethnically diverse populations. We did not, for this particular study, we're not including phenotype information. But we know from many other studies that there is quite a bit of phenotypic diversity amongst these different populations that we studied. And then we analyzed a comparative data set from using data that had already been collected for other studies for the same genetic markers. Roughly 1,300 genetic markers that are spread across the entire genome. And this gave us a total of about 4 million genotypes. So it was a very large genetic study.
How did you and your team choose those particular genetic markers? Had they been identified in the previous study that you mentioned?
Those particular genetic markers are part of a panel called the Marshfield Panel of Markers. They include about 800 microsatellites that are highly variable markers. They're often used, for example, for forensic studies because people tend to vary for the different alleles that they have at these markers. And these markers had been already genotyped in a globally diverse set of populations, but there were very few populations from Africa included in previous studies, only approximately 6 populations from Africa. So Africa wasn't very well represented, but by using the same set of markers, we have this wonderful comparative data set, and we can look at African genetic diversity in the context of the rest of the globe.
In undertaking this study, are these genetic markers enough to tease out all the relationships between populations and subpopulations of people within or among African populations, or did you and your team have to examine cultural and linguistic factors too?
Well, these markers were sufficient to identify quite a bit of genetic diversity on a continental level in Africa. So we were able to identify 14 ancestral genetic clusters based on these markers, and we could certainly distinguish populations from different geographic regions and from certain ethnic groups, not always specific single tribes, but often people who speak a common language would tend to cluster together genetically. What we were not able to do is amongst people who speak a Niger-Kordofanian language and come from Western Africa, they were fairly genetically homogeneous, and we did not have enough markers to clearly be able to distinguish a lot of genetic substructure amongst populations from that region. We were, however, able to identify people who speak a language classified as Bantu, and they originate from Cameroon and south along the western coast of Africa. and those who speak a non-Bantu Niger-Kordofanian language who originate from Nigeria and west along the coast of Africa. But I think that using more markers, so for example, using some of the SNPs or single nucleotide polymorphisms, using SNP panels that have been developed that have a million markers will certainly be informative for future studies for getting even more knowledge about more subtle diversity within geographic regions or amongst closely related ethnic groups.
What are some of the main features of the genomic comparison or the genome comparison between populations of people? And let's start with the African populations and African-American populations. So not the rest of the world, but just between and among African populations and African-American populations.
So first, we saw tremendous amounts of diversity amongst populations, even within small geographic regions. So, for example, in northern Tanzania, you have populations in that region who speak languages belonging to four major language families, and they represent quite a bit of genetic diversity. As a whole, we identified 14 ancestral genetic clusters from which modern populations originated. We also found a remarkable amount of genetic heterogeneity in most ethnic groups. So most ethnic groups showed mixed ancestry from these different ancestral populations, probably reflecting historic migration events within Africa. So populations migrate into a region and then they admix with the local population. So you have a lot of genetic variability today in Africa. And that genetic variability tended to correlate with geography, but there was also a remarkable correlation with linguistic classification overall. And so when we looked at how the variation is distributed across Africa, we saw that populations who cluster genetically often share a similar language. But there were some exceptions. And those exceptions include the Pygmies from Central Africa. They've lost their indigenous language. They speak the language of the neighboring Bantu people, but genetically they cluster together. There was also a case of Chadic-speaking people from northern Cameroon and from Chad. And although they speak a language that's been classified as belonging to the Afro-Asiatic language family, genetically they look like people who speak a Nilo-Saharan language. So it indicates that at some time in the past there was a language replacement in this group. And that's very interesting to see in what cases do you have correlations between genetic and linguistic and cultural variability, and in what cases you don't, and why that might be. In regards to the African-American population, what we found is that when we looked at African-American individuals, we could trace their ancestry predominantly to Niger-Kordofanian speakers who are predominantly from the western coast of Africa. That's not a surprise based on what we know about the history of the slave trade. We also found considerable but quite variable amounts of European ancestry. It could range from 0% in some individuals to greater than 50%. We also found small amounts of ancestry from East Africa, and that may reflect historic slave trade from the southeastern coast of Africa around southern Africa and then to the West Coast, and then people were brought to the Americas.
And how about now the main features of genome comparisons between these African and African-American populations and the rest of the groups that you and your team studied?
Well, we found that the Africans compared to non-African populations, as a whole, Africans have the highest levels of diversity. They have more genetic heterogeneity amongst populations as a whole in the African continent compared to any other geographic region. So, for example, Europeans and people of Middle Eastern descent tended to cluster together genetically, and people from East Asia tended to cluster together. Whereas within Africa, even within a small geographic region, you can identify many different genetic clusters.
Does that genetic diversity of African populations come from the sustained population over the past 200,000 years and the others are less diverse genetically because they were founded by a smaller group?
That's exactly correct. We believe, based on the fossil record, that modern humans originated in Africa within the past 200,000 years, whereas the migration of modern humans out of Africa occurred sometime within the past 50,000 to 100,000 years. So there's clearly been more time for populations to accumulate diversity and to differentiate in Africa compared to non-Africans. And we also think that non-Africans originate from a small founding population that probably migrated out of East Africa. In fact, our study shows that the source of the migration out of Africa was centered on the Dead Sea.
Sarah Tishkoff, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Sarah Tishkoff of the University of Pennsylvania is lead author of a paper on the genetic structure and history of Africans and African Americans. Find the paper at www.scienceexpress.org. Also in this week's Science, flying by Mercury. The Messenger mission to Mercury flew past the planet in October 2008 in its second of three passes designed to place the spacecraft in orbit around Mercury in 2011. And in two reports in this week's issue, scientists focused on the planet's magnetosphere and thin atmospheric layer, which are both highly sensitive to the sun's magnetic field. In two additional reports, scientists analyzed Messenger's new images of Mercury's surface, discussing the evolution of the planet's crust and an impact basin, the second largest on the planet, that measures over 700 kilometers in diameter. Find all four papers in this week's Science. On Monday, U.S. President Barack Obama addressed the members of the National Academy of Sciences at their annual meeting and announced several major initiatives. Here with more about it is Science Deputy Editor Barbara Jasny.
President Obama vowed to devote more than 3% of the U.S. gross domestic product to research and development. That figure is notable because it would be a record high. Greater, he said, than the proportion of R&D spending during the height of the space race half a century ago. He described the increases that are in the federal budget for some key scientific agencies and his goal of a sustained, multi-year plan to double cancer research in the United States. He announced a plan to make permanent the research and experimentation tax credit, which supports private innovation. He also extolled the value and importance of basic research. President Obama set out a wish list of things that science could accomplish, including the development of novel technologies that produce, use, and save energy. His vision includes investing in a new program, the Advanced Research Projects Agency for Energy, to focus on high-risk, high-reward research. ARPA-E, as it is known, has been championed by members of Congress such as House Science and Technology Committee Chairman Bart Gordon. The president also spoke at length of the need to boost science and math education. He challenged states to raise standards, upgrade curriculum, modernize science labs, forge partnerships to improve use of science and technology in classrooms, and increase the number of trained teachers. The $5 billion Race to the Top competition, to be conducted by the Department of Education, was one of the mechanisms mentioned to reach these goals.
That was Deputy Editor Barbara Jasny with a policy update from Science and the AAAS Center for Science, Technology, and Congress.
In this essay on the origin of the immune system, I talk about the two ways our bodies defend themselves against pathogens.
In our year-long series on evolution, Science's Europe News editor John Travis is here with our latest installment, his essay on the origins of the immune system.
And how those defensive systems arose, one that seems to date back to the earliest multicellular creatures, and one that had an incredibly surprising emergence much more recently than we expected. And we know a lot about that second evolutionary jump, but not as much about the more ancient system.
Now, you call it an evolutionary jump, but evolution is typically characterized by sort of a slower, gradual transition. So is pinning down the origin of this second immune response just defining what immunity is and then figuring out when that started?
Not quite. I mean, I think the immunology community took a while to realize there was this second type of immunity, which is known as adaptive immunity. So when they initially studied the immune system, they saw that inflammation happens, and that's the innate immune response. It's the very rapid influx of chemicals and cells that we all know when you get a splinter or an infection. But after that, a few days later, the adaptive immune response kicks in, and that is antibodies and T cells. And those target a microbe much more specifically. And if you look at the animal kingdom, you notice that adaptive immunity isn't in every animal. It's only in the vertebrates. And there are even a few vertebrates that don't have adaptive immunity. And so, obviously, something happened after the invertebrates and vertebrates split off on the evolutionary path. And so immunologists who are studying the evolution of this system have been able to pin it down to a very specific point about 450 million years ago. They can't give you the exact year, but they can tell you kind of when just by which animals have adaptive immunity and which ones don't.
What would be the advantage of this adaptive immune system response?
That remains a pretty big question. Maybe not everyone thinks it's a big question, but a small number of evolutionary biologists do. The obvious answer is you can have a more specific attack on a microbe. The inflammation basically throws everything in the kitchen sink against an infection, and it can drain the body of resources, whereas T cells and B cells that produce antibodies could arguably be much more specific. And Craig Thompson talks about that specificity when he's an immunologist who's looked into this question. And he says that one way to think about it is that the adaptive immune response helps conserve water and nutrients by limiting the immune response.
So if an infection stays around long enough, the body, if it just had this innate immune system, would wear itself out. And so the advantage is having one that uses less of the body's resources?
Well, that's the argument, but you're raising an interesting point, which is there are thousands of species of animals that only have the innate immune response, and many of them live for decades. And so there is a faction of people who say we really don't quite understand what the evolutionary advantage of the adaptive immune response is, because the innate immune response seems to do so well in so many other animals. But I think the most intriguing thing I heard as I reported this essay was that perhaps adaptive immunity didn't evolve to keep out pathogens and microbes, but it was to figure out which ones to allow into our body. One of the things scientists have learned over the years is that we host millions of bacteria in our guts and other parts of our body. And many of those bacteria are helpful to us or important in our development. And so how does the immune system know which bacteria to keep in and which ones to keep out? And so some people are suggesting that's what adaptive immunity is perhaps helping with, or at least plays a role in. And I thought that was a new idea that I wasn't very aware of.
Now, you mentioned at the top that the innate immune system isn't something that we really have a firm grasp on when it started, but that the adaptive one we did. So what exactly happened to allow for the adaptive immune response to evolve?
Well, as you say, the innate immune response goes back so far that almost every animal has it, so it's tough to piece together how it gradually developed. But for the adaptive immune response, scientists realized maybe about a few decades ago that one of the most important parts of the adaptive immune response depended on two proteins called RAG1 and RAG2. And what these proteins do is they shuffle around DNA in immune cells so that the immune cells can produce a huge diversity of antibodies or receptors on T cells. These are the proteins that recognize microbes and help you respond to those microbes. Now, what happened was several scientists realized that RAG1 and RAG2 weren't in every animal. The genes for them couldn't be found in invertebrates, and they were only found in vertebrates. And so the thought that emerged, there was a hypothesis initially, was that the genes for RAG1 and RAG2 jumped into vertebrates at some point in evolutionary history. And those genes that make the proteins RAG1 and RAG2, then evolved to create this system where you could create diverse antibodies. It's a process called VDJ recombination, and that's a mouthful, and I don't think I want to go into complete detail on it. But the idea became, you know, all of a sudden these genes popped into vertebrates and poof, adaptive immunity was able to start working. It wasn't quite that fast of a process. So you talked about evolution being a gradual transition. When these genes popped into vertebrates, then evolution played with them until this VDJ recombination was working. So you might be asking, where did the genes come from? And the really interesting answer is perhaps a virus or another microbe infected a fish-like creature 450 million years ago. So this would be a creature that only had innate immunity. And yet this virus infected it and delivered these genes for RAG1 and RAG2. And then over millions of years, those genes got turned into an important part of the adaptive immune system. So I find that a little bit kind of ironic that a microbe may have laid the foundations for the defense against microbes that we use today.
John Travis, thank you very much.
My pleasure, Rob.
Science's John Travis writes on the origins of the immune system. You can find the whole series of Origins essays and a companion blog celebrating the year of Darwin at www.sciencemag.org/Darwin. Also in this week's Science, dinosaur proteins. Mary Schweitzer and colleagues have characterized the collagen proteins recovered from a Brachylophosaurus canadensis, a duck-billed herbivore that lived approximately 80 million years ago. Molecular preservation in non-avian dinosaurs is controversial because of the question of whether original molecular components remain associated with the fossils, so the team presents several lines of evidence. For example, the scientists observed transparent, flexible vessels, some containing spherical microstructures and others containing an amorphous red substance. In addition, mass spectrometry indicates that the fossil specimen contains collagen, whose amino acid sequences are very similar to those of modern bird collagen. The data further support the close evolutionary relationship between dinosaurs and birds, and also complement earlier results from Tyrannosaurus rex, in particular, confirming that molecular preservation in Cretaceous dinosaurs is not a unique event. Now, David Grimm, editor of Science's online daily news site, Science Now, is here with a wrap-up of some of the latest science news. Hi, David. I know one of the stories is about instant sunglasses. What are the other two about?
Hey, Rob. Well, the other two stories are one's about night owls, how night owls might have a cognitive advantage over early morning people. And the last one's about how good of a job did China do cleaning up the smoggy air in advance of the Beijing Olympics.
Okay, well, let's start with the instant sunglasses. How instant are we talking about here?
Very instant. We're talking about 30 milliseconds, which is, I think, is shorter than the blink of an eye, probably.
And what happens in those 30 milliseconds?
Well, in those 30 milliseconds, there's a compound, and I'm sure I'm going to mess up this name, but I believe it's pronounced hexaralbimidazole, but we'll call it HABI or HABI, even if you want, for short. And this is a compound that researchers have known for a while, changes color in response to UV light. It's normally colorless, but when it's exposed to UV light, like the light from the sun, it turns blue. And so when researchers have been thinking about applications for this, they've gone, well, that would be great for sunglasses. Imagine, you know, if you had glasses you wanted to wear inside, that they were clear, but the moment you stepped outside, they sort of turned a dark blue or at least a darker color that would potentially filter out some of the sun's rays or at least make the sun not as intense.
Well, if they knew about this compound for so long, why are we only hearing about it now?
Well, the problem with the compound before is that it was too slow. The transformation takes 10 seconds or longer. And obviously, if you're wearing these sunglasses, you don't want to have to wait 10 seconds for the light to dim, you know, every time you go outside. So a team sort of fiddled with this compound hobby a little bit to see if they could increase the reaction time. And the short story is that they were able to add a couple more compounds and they increased this reaction time to 30 milliseconds. So now they've got this super quick transition from colorless to dark blue.
How long does it take to transition back to colorless?
It's the same to transition back. So if you walk right back inside, your sunglasses theoretically would immediately switch to being colorless again.
I imagine a potential problem. Say if you're in the shadow of a tree and the light is passing through the branches and boom, suddenly there's light, suddenly there's not. You could get really disoriented pretty fast.
I guess so. I guess there's some kinks that need to be worked out. It's sort of like these automatic lights on our cars going on in tunnels or if there's shade or something like that. You don't want these glasses to be switching back and forth too rapidly. So, and, you know, they haven't actually even applied this to sunglasses yet. This is just a potential application. But there's actually also one other neat application that has to do with data storage. Right now, a lot of data storage involves switching a magnet on and off, you know, and when it's in an on state or an off state, it records different types of data. And so now we've got this compound that switches colors, you know, so instead of switching magnetic properties, it switches the color. And researchers are wondering, you know, can we apply this to data storage? So the research is cool, but, you know, it goes beyond these instant sunglasses.
So next, good news for night owls. I'm a night owl. What does this mean for me?
Well, Rob, I am not a night owl. I think I'm an early morning person. In fact, I'm pretty sure I am. And, you know, obviously there are differences between night owls and what they call larks. You know, larks get up early and they go to bed early, and night owls go to bed late and they wake up late. And researchers have been trying to figure out, is there any sort of, beyond these sort of superficial differences, are there any sort of cognitive differences between night owls and larks? And that's what this study is all about. And it turns out, Rob, that there's two factors that really control when we go to bed at night. The first is hardwired. It's this internal clock that we have called our circadian rhythm. And this clock wires us to the 24-hour cycle of the day. But the second thing that determines when we go to bed is actually very obvious. It's something called sleep pressure, which is basically the longer you've been awake, the tireder you are, and the more you want to go to sleep.
So our circadian clocks are different. It's not like I could just start getting up earlier and then I would just go to bed earlier as a result.
Right, exactly. And the bigger question is, are there any cognitive differences between us because you're a night owl and I'm a lark?
Does that depend on the time of day?
Well, that's what researchers wanted to find out. I mean, there's so many confounding factors, you know, how much sleep, you know, you and I get and when we go to bed and, you know, are we sort of staying on our circadian clock or are we deviating from our clock? So in this new study, researchers tried to control for all these factors. They took a group of about 15 morning people and 15 night people, and they said, go to bed whenever you want, sleep as long as you want, and about an hour and a half after you wake up, we're going to give you a cognitive test. And the cognitive test they used here was, you know, basically a group of numbers would come on the screen and people would have to look at the numbers and hit a button when a certain number began to change, you know. So it was measuring reaction time and a little bit of our cognitive ability. And again, you know, when they let people sleep as long as they want, they gave this test about an hour and a half after they woke up and also 10 hours after they woke up. And the idea was that, you know, this would control for, you know, whether somebody was sort of hardwired to be a night owl or a lark. It would just take into account, you know, how long somebody had been up. And you would expect, you know, Rob, if you're, say, waking up at 8:30 in the morning and I'm waking up at 6 in the morning, but we both take a test 10 hours after we wake up, we should perform the same because we have the same sleep pressure 10 hours later and we've controlled for our internal clock. But that's not what the researchers found. They found that the night owls did slightly better on this test 10 hours after they woke up than the larks did.
Slightly better, so statistically significantly better?
Right. Their reaction time was about 6% faster. And now when the test was given in an hour and a half after both groups woke up, both groups did pretty much the same. They only saw this difference when they gave the test 10 hours after everybody woke up.
So what's that mean exactly?
Well, what it seems to indicate is that sleep pressure builds up faster in larks like me than it does in night owls like you. As the day goes on, even though we've been awake for the same amount of time, I'm perhaps feeling more tired as the day goes on than you do. And the more tired I feel, the more my brain may start to feel a little cloudy because I'm tired and it may not do as well on a cognitive test.
I suppose that has some real-world consequences.
Well, that's the thing. It's not just a fun study to tell us what the differences are between night owls and larks. You know, it turns out, you know, when a lot of companies are trying to prevent accidents, especially when they have, you know, construction workers or people operating dangerous equipment, A lot of times the risk analysis they use has to do with, you know, what time of day it is. Should people be operating at certain times a day versus other times a day?
Students in schools,
doctors, things like that. And this study suggests that, you know, they should also pay attention to what kind of people they're dealing with. You know, based on this study, if you're dealing with a lark, you may want to have this person not be working as late in the day after they've woken up as you would with a night owl.
Or at least when you're trying to compare one person with another, have them both perform the test in their own schedule.
In their own schedule, exactly.
Okay, well, finally, China's Olympic cleanup. We all saw this on the television. It appeared as if they'd done a pretty good job.
Well, that's what they would have hoped. You know, Rob, Beijing is one of the most polluted cities on Earth. You know, there's a lot of factories there. There's tons of traffic. They've got coal-fired power plants. And, you know, there was a lot of concern in advance of the Olympics that the athletes wouldn't perform as well because there's all these pollutants in the air. So China, you know, launched this big sort of PR push, and they said, you know, we're instituting all these measures. I think they tried to cut in half the number of cars that were driving on each day. They closed a lot of factories in Beijing temporarily, and their goal was to cut automobile emissions by about 60-70% and to cut industrial emissions by about 30%. So these were pretty dramatic goals. And the question is, did the Chinese government succeed?
In the actual emissions curbing or in how much pollution was in the air? Because I remember there was a big wind that came through at one point and sort of cleared things out for a couple of days anyway.
Right. Well, then that was a confounding factor, which we'll talk about in a second. But yeah, it was, you know, the focus really was on the overall pollution in the city. Did China significantly reduce the overall pollution in the air in Beijing?
So where did the data come from?
So researchers looked at satellite data, and you know, there's satellite data going back a number of years, and researchers can look at particular places of the globe and measure what they call aerosols in the air, and that's basically the particulate matter that makes up the pollutants. But they didn't just look at the satellite data. You know, as you just mentioned, Rob, you know, factors like wind can really affect pollution. They can first bring extra pollution into cities because if there's neighboring cities that are polluted, or they can push pollution out of cities by blowing them away. And also things like rain can actually flush pollutants from the air. So the researchers, you know, in addition to the satellite data, were collecting data on wind speed and wind direction and rainfall and even relative humidity. And, you know, they got all these factors together. And what they found was that overall, China was only able to cut about 10-15% of the pollution in the air around Beijing in advance of the Olympics.
So despite the best laid plans, they didn't even come close to accomplishing their goal.
Right. It was only a modest success. And the researchers say the bottom line is really that the government really didn't take the weather, you know, to be simple about it. They really just didn't take the weather into account. It turns out there's a lot of pollution, not just in Beijing, but surrounding Beijing. And if you've got wind that's going to push this polluted air into Beijing, you can take as much pollution as you want out of the air of Beijing. But if it's being blown in from nearby cities, you're not going to accomplish much. And that seems to be what happened here.
Okay. Well, thanks, Dave.
Thanks, Rob.
So what other stories are you looking into for Science Now or on the policy blog, Science Insider?
Well, Rob, for Science Now, we're looking to a couple stories, one about rogue black holes that are wandering the Milky Way, and another one about birds that dance to musical beats. It's a fun study, but it's also telling scientists a lot more about bird cognition. And in the policy blog, as you know, Rob, swine flu is all over the news this week, and we've got a crack team of reporters, people that are experts in pandemics and in virus biology, covering every aspect of this, analyzing the news reports that come out. We've got our own news reports. We've got our own analysis of what's happening. And it's got the special science touch, which means you're really going to get a very in-depth analysis of what's going on biologically with this virus and how it could affect all of us. So you can check all that out on Science Insider, and you can find a link to that on the Science Now homepage.
David Grimm is the editor of Science Now, the online daily news site of science. You can check out the latest science news, plus find a link to the science policy blog, Science Insider, at sciencenow.sciencemag.org. Finally today, we read from your letters to Science Magazine. Joining me is the letters editor, Jennifer Sills.
Our first letter is from the April 10th issue and is part of our Life in Science series. Peter Klopfer writes in from Duke University to describe his return to the United States after doing some fieldwork.
Klopfer writes, "We had been examining the selectivity and food choices made by some tropical birds. Our procedure was to compare stomach contents of seed-eating birds with the abundance of different seeds available, most of which were of various species of grasses. We planned to do the actual analyses at home, so we arrived at Miami International Airport with several boxes of bird stomachs and vials of seeds.
Klapfer continues, all were properly presented to the agricultural authorities, and, armed with the necessary papers and seals, we proceeded to the customs bench. We were an unkempt group, as might be expected after days of fieldwork and Spartan living conditions, so we were not surprised to be asked to open our cases and backpacks and to account for their contents. "What is this?" asked the officer, picking up several of our vials. I explained that the vials contained seeds. "What kind of seeds?" he persisted. I replied that they were merely grass seeds.
An instant later, Klopfer writes, the red light on the officer's desk began flashing, and I found myself surrounded by a phalanx of uniforms. A senior officer quickly joined the group, looked at the vials, scrutinized me and my perplexed expression. After all, I did have Agriculture Department clearance. And then solemnly intoned, anyone so square as to tell you they are transporting grass seeds is bound to be okay. To this day, the students that accompanied me still giggle at the recollection, although whether they're laughing because I was accused of transporting marijuana or because I was too square to pull off the role, I'll never know.
Our next letter comes from the April 17th issue and is in response to Christopher Reddy's March 13th editorial, Scientist Citizens. In that editorial, Reddy argues that scientists need to be better able to explain their work to policymakers and the general public, and that it is their responsibility to do so in order to receive public funds to do research.
Jameson Wetmore from Arizona State University and colleagues write, if we as scientist citizens want to be understood, we should begin by listening. AAAS recognized this over 30 years ago when it established its Science and Technology Policy Fellowship Program, which gives PhD science graduates one-year opportunities to collaborate with policymakers and play an active role in decision-making.
Shorter-term immersions can also help, the authors write. The Consortium for Science Policy and Outcomes and the American Meteorological Society both offer two-week policy experiences in Washington, D.C. for early career scientists. Participants converse with, challenge, and share ideas with policymakers, including congressional staffers, agency officials, lobbyists, regulators, journalists, academics, and museum curators.
The authors conclude, if scientists are going to be citizens, they need to practice in not just communicating their ideas, but having a two-way dialogue with policymakers and the public. You can read the full letter in the April 17th issue.
Our final letter comes from the April 24th issue and relates to the February 13th policy forum by Leah Gerber and colleagues on whether whale populations should be reduced to increase fishery yield. In that policy forum, the authors argue that whaling does not provide direct benefit to fisheries, but rather leads to the loss of species that are important for the structural integrity of their ecosystem.
David Bellata and Stefano Mariani from University College Dublin write in support of the policy forum. They write, the complex and often fragile interactions among organisms and between them and the natural environment make it unreasonable to reduce ecology to a sum of cause and effect phenomena. Recent studies have shown the dramatic consequences of biodiversity loss in the oceans and its ripple effects on trophic webs. Such dramatic changes have occurred as a byproduct of unsustainable fisheries management. Fiddling with the system by actively removing cetacean populations would result in unfathomable damages.
The authors conclude, even if cetaceans were significantly hampering the rebuilding of fish stocks, and their removal were inconsequential for the system, would anyone have the right to intervene and cull? From a purely ethical standpoint, the answer is no. It would be farcical to let an entire order of already endangered mammals take the blame for our gross mismanagement of the planet's living resources. You can read the full letter in the April 24th issue of Science.
Thanks, Jennifer.
Thanks, Rob.
Jennifer Sills is the letters editor of Science Magazine. And that wraps up the May 1st, 2009 Science Magazine podcast. If you have any comments or suggestions for the show, please write us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org. The show is a production of Science Magazine with the support of AAAS, the Science Society. Jeffrey Cook composed the music, and I'm Robert Frederick. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, thanks for joining us.